The Night Sky for May 2008 is part of the Jodcast. For the full show and the archives, go to jodcast.net.
Well, the night sky for May. As the sun sets, the constellations of Taurus the Bull and Gemini are setting over towards the west. Leo is fairly high in the southwest, and over to the lower left of the constellation Leo is the constellation of Virgo. Fairly empty area of the sky, as seen by our unaided eye. There is one bright star, Spica, the brightest star of Virgo. But telescopes show a wonderful number of galaxies forming part of what is called the Virgo cluster that stretches from Denebola, which is the sort of the tail of Leo the Lion, across towards Spica. But as I said, to our eyes, we don't see anything too exciting. Above Leo, high in the sky, is the constellation of Ursa Major, the Great Bear. The part that we always see is the latter part, the body and the tail of the bear, that we call in England the plough, but in the United States they call it the Big Dipper. And it's a very nice constellation with lots of interesting things to look at. On the night sky page of the Jodrell Bank website, in fact, there's quite a complete description of some of the many objects you can see in the region of all of these constellations. So what about the planets? Well, it's actually not a bad month for planets. One thing that we'll be able to see at its best this year is the planet Mercury, because it reaches what is called greatest elongation. That's the greatest angle away from the sun around the middle of the month. And the angle of the ecliptic is fairly steep, steeply inclined to the horizon. So it's actually, for a few days, well above the horizon. If it were clear on the 6th of May, we could have a wonderful skyscape, low in the west, just to the west-northwest, actually, just after sunset. Closest to the horizon will be that lovely little star cluster, the Pleiades. Then we'll have a very thin crescent moon. I think it'll be 1.6 days after new. That really is thin. And just above that to the left, the planet Mercury. On the night sky page, I've actually put a track of Mercury over the first couple of weeks of May, so you can see where it should be in the sky. I think you'll need binoculars. You'll also need somewhere where you have a very good low western horizon, because I'm afraid they're not terribly high in the sky, but it would be a wonderful chance to see not only a very thin crescent moon, but also the planet Mercury. Now, Saturn is, of course, visible fairly high in the southwest after sunset. It's in the constellation of Leo, and it starts the month just 2 degrees to the left, or towards the east, perhaps I should say, of Leo's brightest star, Regulus. It's not quite as bright as we sometimes see it because the rings are closing, and next year they'll be edge-on, so for a couple of times we won't actually see the rings at all. But because their angle is inclined quite steeply to us, there's rather less reflecting area, so as a whole, Saturn appears less bright than it sometimes does. But it's well worth looking at, and if you have a small telescope, you can easily pick up its brightest moon, which is Titan. And if you have perhaps an 8-inch telescope and dark skies, you should be able to see perhaps 3 or 4 other satellites as well. It's a very worthwhile object to observe. Now, Jupiter, it's been a morning object for a month or so, but in fact by the end of May it actually rises just before midnight. At the beginning it's about 1:30, about 3 hours or so before sunrise. And sadly, this year, and in fact it's been the same last year and a bit next year, it is at the lowest point in the ecliptic, being the path of the sun round the sky. And it's where the sun is during midwinter, so that the sun, as you know, isn't very high then. The trouble is that means we see it through a fairly thick atmosphere. That has two effects. One is simply that the little turbulence bubbles that we have in the atmosphere tend to blur the image. But another one is due to refraction, that the images we see of Jupiter in the different colours of light are stacked one above the other. That also has a blurring effect. So with a telescope, you can actually sometimes see a clearer image looking through what's called a narrow band filter. They cost about £60. There's one in the oxygen 3 line, sort of a greenish colour line. And because you're looking at just one wavelength of light, then the effects of refraction don't matter. So that might be a trick if you're trying to observe Jupiter with a telescope. But you'll still be able to see the four Galilean moons as they weave their way around it. Well, there's not many to go. Mars is still nice and high in the sky after sunset. It's in the constellation of Gemini. On May the 5th, it actually moves from Gemini into Cancer. And on the 5th, the night of the 5th, it's actually in a direct straight line with the stars Castor and Pollux of Gemini. I saw it the other night, actually, looking interestingly close. But in a couple of days' time, by May the 5th, you'll actually see a dead straight line, well worth looking out for. It's getting fairly small now, just about 5 arc seconds. It looks a sort of a salmony pink colour. So it's very unlikely you'll see any detail with a telescope. I was very surprised when a colleague of mine showed me a webcam-based image taking many, many short exposures and stacking them together just a week or so ago, and it did in fact show Syrtis Major. So, with luck, it is still just possible to see a little detail on the surface of Mars. There's a very nice website called Astronomy Photograph of the Day. We always call it APOD. So just put APOD into Google, you'll find it. And in the last month, it's had some lovely photographs of the moon, of one of the moons of Mars, and a great detail image showing one of the craters. So that perhaps will be worth looking at. The only planet I haven't mentioned of the bright ones is Venus. It's very, very low above the horizon at the moment, almost impossible to observe because of the glare of the sun. We're going to have to wait really towards mid to end July to actually see it in the evening sky. It has been a morning object, but it's very, very close to the sun now and probably not worth trying to look for. Well, in fact, I have actually mentioned some of the highlights of the month already. There's nothing really much more to say. We don't have any meteor showers of any note this month. But perhaps I could bring your attention to a little bit on the Night Sky website that tells you where and when to look for the International Space Station. At a Macclesfield Astronomy Society meeting earlier in April, there was a pass due during the meeting. We went out just below the Lovell telescope, and a colleague of mine took a wonderful photograph, not only of the International Space Station, but also Jules Verne, which is the unmanned transfer craft to carry cargo up to the International Space Station. So have a look at that picture. I'm afraid I have looked to see if there are any reasonable viewings of the International Space Station during May. From England, sadly not. One night I think you can see it rather low in the south from London, but it's not a good month, I'm afraid, to see it. But do look at that site every so often, and you never know, you might find it'll cross the sky high above you, and it really does look very, very impressive. So, good hunting for the month of May. Now, we've had an email from Paul Medway, or Medway, and he says, I have just borrowed a telescope to have a poke about the sky, but I'd really like to be able to take some photographs. What would be a good beginner's telescope that I could do this with? Would I need to have a camera with specific features? Well, let's assume that we're talking about digital cameras now, and there are lots and lots of compact cameras, and in fact, any of these can be used with a telescope to take very nice photographs. It doesn't really matter too much what the telescope is. The first thing to try and do is to have a go at photographing the moon. The moon's very bright, so the exposures are basically 1/100th or 2/100th of a second, and so you don't even have to have a camera mounted on the telescope or on a tripod. You can just look through the telescope at the moon, focus it, and then hold your camera up to the eyepiece and press the button. And with a bit of luck, it will focus and you'll have a very nice little image of the moon. It's a very good way to start. Now, if you want to photograph fainter objects, like, say, the Pleiades cluster, other objects like that, then you need longer exposures. And that means you do have to mount the telescope rigidly with the camera. There's a device called the Bader Planetarium Microstage. Sounds a bit complicated. Basically, it's a little stage on which you can mount your camera. And you can dial it acrosswards and also vertically. So you can actually get the position of the lens of the camera precisely aligned with the eyepiece of the telescope. That's actually quite important. And when you do that, obviously the two are rigidly aligned, the stage actually clamps around the eyepiece. So it's actually quite easy to use. And you can then start taking longer exposure photographs. A lot of cameras will have a night mode, and sometimes they will actually take a photograph, let's say with an exposure of 30 seconds, and it will all go quiet for another 30 seconds as it takes a second image, but without opening the shutter. And that allows it to eliminate the effect of what are called hot pixels, little bits of the CCD array that perhaps show up when they shouldn't do. I have a little Panasonic Lumix FX12, I think, only costing £100, and even that has that feature. So that's something to look out for, a sort of a night mode where it actually does take what's called a dark sky frame, a blank frame, so it can actually correct for any errors in the CCD array. What sort of telescope should you use? Well, a very nice telescope that I review on the website is the Celestron 130 SLT. It's a little Newtonian reflector, 130 millimeters aperture. Very nice, on quite a nice mount, and I've certainly used the technique I've just mentioned on that telescope to take some nice photographs. At far greater expense, one can get some lovely small refractors, about 80 millimeters aperture, but they tend to cost £100, a couple hundred pounds, and then you have to have a mount as well. So the Celestron informs either with a computerized mount or without, you can get from, let's say, £180 upwards. Just have a hunt around on the websites and see what you can get. Skywatcher produce some very nice ones, which perhaps are a little bit cheaper. So anyway, best of luck.